Coxon by Robin Cook. Continued. Cassette 4, Side 1. Becky's eyes were closed. Her skin was a translucent bluish-white. "Becky, it's me, Dad," Kim whispered into her ear. He studied her frozen face. She didn't register any sign of hearing.
"Unfortunately, she's unresponsive," Claire said.
Kim straightened up. His breaths were shallow and rapid. "You think she's had a stroke?"
"Every indication suggests as much," Sidney said.
Kim had to remind himself not to blame the messenger.
"The basic problem is that the toxin seems to be destroying her platelets as fast as we give them," Walter said.
"It's true," Sidney said. "There's no way to know if this was an intracranial hemorrhage or a platelet embolus."
"Or a combination of the two," Walter suggested.
"That's a possibility," Sidney admitted.
"One way or another," Walter added, "the rapid destruction of her platelets must be forming a sludge in her microcirculation. We're into that cascading major organ failure situation that we hate to see."
"Kidney and liver function is definitely going down," Arthur said. "The peritoneal dialysis is not keeping up."
Kim had to steel himself to curtail his anger at this self-serving dialectic. It certainly wasn't helping his daughter. He tried to think and remain rational.
"If the peritoneal dialysis is not working," Kim said in a deceptively calm voice,
"perhaps we should transfer her to the suburban hospital and get her on a dialysis machine."
"That's out of the question," Claire said. "She's too critical to be transferred."
"Well, it seems to me we have to do something," Kim shot back, his anger bubbling to the surface.
"I think we are doing all we can," Claire said. "We're actively supporting her respiratory and kidney functions and replacing her platelets."
"What about plasmapheresis?" Kim said. Claire looked at Walter.
"Americare is reluctant to authorize it," Walter said.
"Screw Americare," Kim spat. "If there's a chance you think it could help, let's do it."
"Hold on, Dr. Regis," Walter said.
The gray-haired man shifted his weight. He was obviously uncomfortable about this issue.
"Americare owns this hospital. We can't just go thumbing our noses at their rules. Plasmapheresis is expensive and experimental. With lay families, I'm not even supposed to bring it up."
"How do we go about getting them to authorize it?" Kim questioned. "I'll pay for it myself if it can help."
"I'd have to call Dr. Norman Shapiro," Walter said. "He's the chairman of the Americare Review Board."
"Call him," Kim barked. "Right now." Walter looked at Claire. Claire shrugged.
"I suppose a call can't hurt."
"Okay by me," Walter said.
He left the room to use the phone at the ICU desk.
"Dr. Regis, plasmapheresis is grasping at straws," Claire said. "I think it's only fair to tell you, and your former wife, that you should be preparing yourselves for all eventualities."
Kim saw red. He was in no frame of mind to prepare himself, as Claire euphemistically suggested. Instead, he wanted to strike out at the people responsible for Becky's sorry state, and at that moment his nearest targets were the doctors in that very room.
"You do understand what I'm saying, don't you?"
Claire asked gently. Kim didn't answer. In a suddenly clairvoyant moment, he comprehended the absurdity of blaming these doctors for Becky's plight, especially when he knew where the fault lay. Without warning, Kim broke away from Claire and rushed out of the ICU. He was beside himself with anger, frustration, and his humiliating sense of impotence. He started down the hall. Tracy was still in the waiting room. She spotted Kim's hasty exit and immediately knew he was in a rage. When he passed by without a glance, she ran to catch up to him. She was afraid what he might do.
"Kim, stop! Where are you going?"
She pulled on his sleeve.
"Out," he said, breaking away.
"Where?" Tracy had to run merely to keep up with Kim's determined stride. The look on his face frightened her. For the moment, she forgot her own grief.
"I've got to do something," he said. "I can't just sit here and wring my hands. Right now, I can't help Becky medically, but by God, I'm going to find out how she got sick."
"How are you going to find out?" Tracy asked. "Kim, you have to calm down." "Kathleen told me the E. coli problem is mainly a problem with ground meat," Kim said.
"Everybody knows that," Tracy said.
"Yeah, well, I guess I didn't," Kim said. "And remember when I told you that a week ago I took Becky to the Onion Ring on Prairie Highway? She had a burger, and it was rare. That had to have been when she got sick."
So you mean to tell me you're going to the Onion Ring restaurant now? Tracy asked incredulously.
Obviously, Kim said. If that's where Becky got sick, that's where I'm going.
Right now it doesn't matter where Becky got sick, Tracy said. What matters is she is sick. We can worry about the how and the why some other time.
It might not matter to you, Kim said, but it matters to me.
Kim, you're out of control, Tracy said with exasperation. Just once, can't you think of someone else besides yourself?
What the hell do you mean? Kim snapped, feeling even more enraged.
This is about you, not about Becky. It's about you and your doctor ego.
The hell it is, Kim growled. I'm in no mood to listen to any of your psychological nonsense. Not now.
You're not helping anyone by running off like this, Tracy said. You're a threat even to yourself. If you have to go, at least wait until you have calmed down.
I'm going in hopes it can calm me down, Kim said, and maybe even give me an ounce of satisfaction. The elevator arrived and Kim boarded.
But you haven't even changed out of your scrub clothes, Tracy said, hoping to find some way to delay him for his own good.
I'm going, Kim said, right now. Nobody's going to stop me.
Kim pulled into the Onion Ring parking lot fast enough to bottom out on the lip of the driveway. There was a muffled thump, and a shudder went through the car. Kim didn't care. He took the first parking spot he came to. After putting on the emergency brake and turning off the ignition, Kim sat in the car for a moment and looked out the windshield at the restaurant. It was as crowded as it had been a week earlier. The drive from the hospital had blunted the edge of his anger, but not his determination. He thought about what he'd do once he was inside and then got out of the car. Passing through the main entrance, he found the lines at the cash registers stretched almost to the door. Unwilling to wait, he pushed his way to the front. Some of the customers complained. Kim ignored them. Once at the counter, Kim got the attention of one of the cash register girls, whose name tag said, "Hi, I'm Debbie." She was a nondescript teenager with bleached hair and mild acne. Her facial features were frozen into an expression of absolute boredom.
"Excuse me," Kim said, forcing himself to sound calm, even though it was apparent he was not. "I'd like to speak to the manager."
"You have to wait in line to order," Debbie said.
She glanced briefly at Kim, but was completely insensitive to his state of mind.
"I don't want to order," Kim said slowly and deliberately. "I want to speak to the manager."
"He's like really busy right now," Debbie said.
She turned her attention back to the person standing at the head of her line and asked that the order be repeated. Kim slammed his open palm down on the countertop with such force that it caused several napkin holders to vibrate off and fall with a clatter to the floor. The sound was like a shotgun blast. In an instant, the entire restaurant went silent like a freeze frame in a movie. Debbie turned pearl white.
"I don't want to have to ask again," Kim said. "I want the manager."
A man stepped forward from a position next to the central island behind the row of cash registers. He was dressed in a two-tone Onion Ring uniform. His name tag said, "Hi, I'm Roger."
"I'm the manager," he said. His head twitched nervously.
"What's the problem?"
"It's my daughter," Kim said. "She happens to be in a coma at the moment, fighting for her life, all from eating a hamburger here 1 week ago."
Kim was loud enough to make himself heard throughout the restaurant. Those customers who were eating burgers eyed them suspiciously.
"I'm sorry to hear about your daughter," Roger said. "But there's no way she could have gotten sick here, least of all from one of our burgers."
"This is the only place she had ground meat," Kim said, "and she's sick with E. coli, and that comes from hamburger."
"Well, I'm sorry," Roger said emphatically. "But our burgers are all cooked well done, and we've got strict rules about cleanliness. We're inspected regularly by the Department of Health."
As abruptly as the restaurant had gone silent, it returned to its high level of background noise. Conversations recommenced as if the collective judgment was that whatever Kim's problem was, it didn't concern them. "Her burger wasn't well done," Kim said. "It was rare."
"Impossible," Roger contended with a roll of his eyes.
"I saw it myself," Kim said. "It was pink in the middle. What I'd like to ask..."
"It couldn't have been pink," Roger interjected with a dismissive wave. "It's out of the question. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to get back to work."
Roger began to turn away from the counter.
Kim responded by lashing out and grabbing a handful of Roger's onion ring shirt. With his powerful arms, Kim pulled the startled manager over the counter so that his face was inches from Kim's. Instantly, it began to empurple. Kim's iron-like grip was restricting blood flow in Roger's neck. A little remorse might be appropriate, Kim snarled. Certainly not uninformed blanket denial. Roger gurgled incomprehensibly while he ineffectually grappled with Kim's locked fingers. Kim rudely pushed Roger back over the counter and let go of him, sending him to the floor. The cashiers, the rest of the kitchen staff, and the people waiting in line gasped, but stood rooted in shocked immobility. Kim rounded the end of the counter, intending to talk directly with the chef. Roger scrambled to his feet, and seeing Kim coming into the kitchen area, he tried to confront him. "You can't come back here," he said gamely. "Only employees are allowed." Kim didn't give him time to finish. He simply shoved him out of the way, slamming the manager into the counter. The collision displaced a plastic juice machine, which crashed to the tiles. Juice sloshed out in a wide arc across the floor. Those nearest jumped out of the way. The restaurant again quieted. A few of the patrons left hurriedly, taking their food with them. "Call the police," Roger croaked to the nearest cashier as he scrambled to his feet. Kim continued around the central island to confront the wizened Paul. Kim took in the leathered face and the tattooed arm and wondered about the man's personal hygiene. Like everyone else in the kitchen, Paul hadn't moved from the moment Kim had pounded the counter. Some of the burgers on the grill in front of him were smoking. "My daughter had a rare burger here just about this time a week ago," Kim growled. "I want to know how that could have happened." Roger came up behind Kim and tapped him on the shoulder. "You're going to have to leave," he said. Kim spun around. He'd had quite enough of the pesky manager. Roger wisely backed up. He raised his palms. "Okay, okay," he mumbled. Kim turned back to Paul. "Any ideas?" he asked. "No," Paul said. He'd seen people go crazy on oil rigs, and the look in Kim's eyes reminded him of these men. "Come on," Kim snarled. "You must have been the cook. You have to have some idea."
"Like Roger said," Paul asserted, "it couldn't have been rare. I cook all the burgers well done. It's policy."
"You people are really starting to piss me off," Kim snapped. "I'm telling you, it was rare. I didn't get this second hand. I was here with my daughter. I saw it."
"But I timed them," Paul said.
He pointed with his spatula to the smoking patties on the grill.
Kim grabbed one of a half dozen completed burgers that Paul had put on the shelf above the grill for Roger to place on order trays. Kim rudely broke the burger open and examined the inside of the meat patty. It was well done. He repeated this three more times, slapping the broken hamburgers back onto the plates.
"You see," Roger said, "they're all well done. Now if you'll step out of the kitchen area, we can discuss this more calmly." "We cooked them to an inside temperature higher than the one proposed by the FDA," Paul said.
"How do you know the inside temperature?" Kim asked.
"We gauge it with a special 5-pronged thermometer," Roger said. "We take the temperature randomly several times a day, and it's always the same, above 170 degrees.
Paul put down his spatula and rummaged in a drawer below the grill. He produced the instrument and offered it to Kim. Kim ignored the thermometer. He took another hamburger and broke it open. It, too, was well done. "Where do you store the patties before they're cooked?" Paul turned around and opened the refrigerator. Kim bent over and peered inside. He knew he was only looking at a small portion of the meat the onion ring had to have on hand.
"Where's the bulk of them?" Kim questioned. "In the walk-in freezer," Paul said.
"Show me," Kim commanded.
Paul looked at Roger.
"No way," Roger said. "The walk-in is off-limits."
Kim gave Paul a shove in the chest with both hands, propelling the man toward the back of the kitchen. Paul stumbled backward, then turned and started to walk. Kim followed.
"No, you don't," Roger said.
He'd caught up to Kim and pulled on his arm.
"Only employees are allowed in the freezer."
Kim tried to shake Roger off his arm, but Roger hung on. Frustrated, Kim backhanded the manager across the face with significantly more force than he'd intended. The power of the blow snapped Roger's head around, split his upper lip, and sent him crashing to the floor for the second time. Without even a glance at the fallen manager, Kim followed after Paul, who now had the freezer door open. Kim stepped inside. Fearful of Kim's size and impulsiveness, Paul gave him a wide berth. Paul looked back at his manager, who was now sitting on the rubber kitchen mat, dabbing at his bloodied lip. Unsure of what to do, he followed Kim into the freezer. Kim was looking at the cartons lined up on the left side of the walk-in. Only the first was open. The labels read, Mercer Meats, Regulation 1-Pound Hamburger Patties, Extra Lean, Lot 2, Batch 1 through 5, Production, December 29th, Use by March 29th. Would a hamburger last Friday night have come from this carton? Kim asked. Paul shrugged.
Probably, or one similar.
Kim stepped back into the depths of the freezer and saw another open carton nestled among the sealed ones. He opened it and looked in. He could see that the wrapping was also broken on one of the inner boxes. How come this carton is open? He asked.
It was a mistake, Paul said. We're supposed to use the oldest patties first, so we never have to worry about the use-by date.
Kim looked at the label. It was similar to the previous one, except for the production date. This one said January 12th instead of December 29th. Could a patty have come from this one last Friday? He asked.
Possibly, Paul said. I don't remember the day it was mistakenly opened.
Slipping a pen and piece of paper from the pocket of his white coat, Kim wrote down the information on the labels of the two open cartons. Then he took a single patty from each. This wasn't easy because the patties were frozen in stacks separated by sheets of waxed paper. He pocketed the patties and the paper. As Kim exited the freezer, he was vaguely aware of the muffled sound of a siren whining down. In his preoccupied state, he ignored it. "What's Mercer Meats?" he asked Paul. Paul closed the freezer door.
"It's a meat processing company that supplies us with hamburger patties," he said. "In fact, they supply the entire onion ring chain."
"Is it in this state?" Kim asked.
"Sure is," Paul said. "It's right outside of town in Bartonville."
"That's convenient," Kim said. As Kim walked back into the kitchen area, the front door of the restaurant burst open. Two uniformed police officers came charging in with their hands resting on their holstered revolvers. Their faces were grim. Roger trailed behind them, angrily gesturing toward Kim with his right hand, while his left held a bloody napkin against his mouth. Chapter 12. Saturday, January 24th. Weak early morning sunlight slanted through the moat-filled air of the courtroom and created a swath of light on the floor. Kim was standing in the beam and squinting from the glare. In front of him, Judge Harlow was presiding, in his black judicial robes. Reading glasses were perched precariously on the judge's narrow, knife-like nose. To Kim, he appeared like an enormous black bird.
"After more than 20 years on the bench," Judge Harlow was saying while glaring down at Kim over the top of his spectacles, "I should not be surprised at what I see and hear, but this is one strange story."
"It's because of my daughter's condition," Kim said. He was still attired in his long white coat over hospital scrubs, with his surgical mask still tied around his neck. But the coat was no longer crisp and clean. From having slept in it overnight in jail, it was wrinkled and soiled. Below the left pocket was a reddish-brown stain.
"Doctor, I have great sympathy for you, given that your daughter is gravely ill," Judge Harlow said. "What I have trouble understanding is why you are not at the hospital at her side."
"I should be," Kim said. "But her condition is such, there is nothing I can do. Besides, I had only intended to be away for an hour or so."
"Well, I'm not here to make value judgments," Judge Harlow said. "What I am here for is to address your behavior in regard to trespassing, committing battery on a fast food restaurant manager, and perhaps, most egregious of all, resisting arrest and striking a police officer. Doctor, this is unacceptable behavior no matter the circumstances."
"But, Your Honor, I..." Kim began. Judge Harlow raised his hand to quiet Kim.
"It doesn't matter that you suspect your daughter's illness might have originated at the Onion Ring on Prairie Highway. You, of all people, should know we have a Department of Health which is mandated to look into this kind of thing, and we have courts of law. Am I making myself clear?"
"Yes, Your Honor," Kim said resignedly.
"I hope you seek some help, Doctor," Judge Harlow said. "I'm plainly mystified by your actions, knowing that you're a renowned cardiac surgeon.
In fact, you operated on my father-in-law, and he still sings your praises. At any rate, I'm releasing you on your own recognizance. You're to return for trial 4 weeks hence. See the court clerk.
Judge Harlow struck his gavel and asked for the next case. On his way out of the courthouse, Kim eyed a public phone. He hesitated for a moment, trying to decide whether or not to call the hospital. The evening before, he'd tried to call Tracy, but he'd failed to reach her with the calls he had been allotted. Now, with the phone available, he dithered. He felt guilty about having been gone for so long, as well as embarrassed for what had happened. He was also afraid of what he might find out about Becky. He decided to go rather than call. At a cab stand just outside the courthouse, Kim caught a cab to the Onion Ring. The deserted restaurant looked completely different in the morning prior to its opening. Kim's aging vehicle was the only one in the parking lot, and there wasn't a soul in sight. Climbing in his car, Kim set out for the hospital. En route, he made a detour to Sharing Labs. Inside, he approached a receiving counter and rang a stainless steel bell. A woman appeared within seconds. She was dressed in a lab coat. Kim fished the two hamburger patties, now defrosted, out of his left pocket and handed them to the woman. "I'd like these patties tested for E. coli 0157H7, he said. "Also for the toxin." The technician eyed the discolored meat warily.
"I think it might have been better if you'd refrigerated the samples," she said. "When meat's been at room temperature for more than a couple of hours, it's going to grow out a lot of bacteria."
"I understand that," Kim said, "but I don't care about other bacteria. I only want to know if E. coli 0157H7 is present." The woman disappeared for a moment. She returned wearing latex gloves. She took the meat and put each sample into a separate container. Then she took the billing details. Kim used his office account.
"How long will it take?" Kim asked. "We'll have a final reading in 48 hours, she replied.
Kim thanked her, washed his hands in a restroom, and went back out to his car. As he neared the hospital, Kim became increasingly anxious. He started trembling as he parked his car. The tremors grew worse as he rose up in the elevator. Preferring to face Tracy after checking on Becky, he used a back route to the ICU to avoid the ICU waiting room. As he passed through the halls, people eyed him with curiosity. Kim could well understand, considering his appearance. Besides his soiled attire, he needed a shower and a shave, and his hair needed combing. Within the ICU, Kim nodded to the ward clerk, but didn't offer any explanation. Approaching Becky's cubicle, he found himself making a pact with God. If only Becky could be spared. Kim slipped in by Becky's bedside. A nurse was changing her IV bottle. Her back was to him. Kim gazed at his daughter. Any faint sliver of hope of improvement he had entertained instantly vanished. Becky was obviously still in a coma. Her eyelids were taped shut, and she was still intubated and being respired. What was new were large, deep purple patches of subcutaneous bleeding under the skin of her face that made her look cadaverous.
"Oh, my goodness, you frightened me," the nurse said when she caught sight of Kim. She put a hand to her chest. "I didn't hear you."
"She doesn't look good," Kim said. He kept his voice even, in an attempt to hide the grief, anger, and humiliating impotence he felt.
"I'm afraid not," the nurse said, eyeing Kim with some misgivings. "The poor little angel has been having a terrible time."
Kim's trained ear drew his attention to the cardiac monitor screen. The beeping was irregular, as were the blips of the cursor.
"She has an arrhythmia? When did this develop?"
"Relatively recently," the nurse said. "It started last night. She developed a cardiac effusion, which quickly brought on symptoms of tamponade. She had to be tapped."
"When?" Kim asked. Now he felt even more guilty for not having been available. Dealing with a cardiac effusion was something he knew about.
"Just after 4 this morning," the nurse said. "Are any of her doctors still here?" Kim asked.
"I believe so," the nurse said. "I think they're talking to the patient's mother in the waiting room."
Kim fled. He couldn't stand to see his daughter in such a condition. Out in the corridor, he paused to catch his breath and regain some composure. Then he walked down to the waiting room. He found Tracy talking with Claire Stevens and Kathleen Morgan. As soon as they saw Kim, their conversation stopped. For a moment, there was silence.
Tracy was clearly distraught. Her mouth was a grim line. She had her knees pressed together and her hands clasped. She gazed at Kim with a sad, confused expression, reflecting both concern and contempt. She shook her head.
"You're in the same clothes. You're a mess. Where on earth have you been?"
My visit to the onion ring took a lot longer than I thought it would. He looked at Claire.
"So Becky has now developed pericarditis?"
"I'm afraid so," Claire said.
"My God," Kim exclaimed. "What next?"
"At this stage, just about anything," Kathleen said. "We've confirmed that this is a particularly pathogenic strain of E. coli that produces not one, but two extraordinarily potent toxins. What we're seeing is full-blown HUS."
"What about the plasmapheresis?" Kim asked.
"Dr. Ohanesian made an impassioned plea to the Americare Review Board chairman," Claire said. "But as we warned, the committee probably will not give the okay."
"Why not?" Kim demanded. "We've got to do something, and I said I'd be willing to pay for it."
"Your being willing to pay doesn't matter," Claire said. "From their point of view, it would set a dangerous precedent. They could then be forced to offer it to families that couldn't or wouldn't pay."
"Then let's get Becky to some place where it is offered," Kim snapped.
"Dr. Regis," Claire said sympathetically, "Becky is in worse condition today than she was yesterday, and yesterday she was in no condition to be transferred. But plasmapheresis is not totally out of the question. There's still hope they could give the green light. We'll just have to wait."
"Wait and do nothing," Kim said with a scowl.
"That's not true," Claire said hotly.
Then she caught herself and sighed. Talking with Kim was a chore she did not relish.
"We're supporting her every way possible."
"Meaning you're sitting on your hands and treating complications," Kim spat. Claire stood up and looked at Tracy and Kathleen.
"I think it's time for me to see the rest of my inpatients, but I'll be available if needed. Just page me."
Tracy nodded. Kathleen responded that she'd be doing the same thing in a few minutes. Claire left. Kim collapsed into the chair vacated by Claire and buried his head in his hands. He was struggling with a roller coaster of emotions. First anger and then sadness, then back to anger. Now sadness returned. He fought back tears. He knew he should be seeing his own inpatients, but for the moment he was incapable.
"Why did your visit to the onion ring take so long?" Tracy asked.
As irritated as she was by his behavior, she couldn't help but be concerned about him. He looked pitiful. "Actually, I was in jail," Kim admitted.
"Jail?"
"If you want me to tell you that you were right, you were right," Kim said. "I should have calmed down before I went."
"Why were you in jail?" Tracy asked.
"I lost my temper," Kim said. "I went there to find out about the possibility of tainted meat. The manager's self-righteous denial drove me up the wall."
"I don't think it's the fast food industry's fault," Kathleen offered. "With this E. coli problem, the fast food restaurants are as much a victim as the patrons who are infected. They get contaminated hamburger."
"I figured as much," Kim said, with his face still buried in his hands. "My next visit will be to Mercer Meats."
"With Becky's condition, it's hard for me to think," Tracy said. "But how can there be contaminated meat? Aren't these places continually inspected? I mean, doesn't the USDA certify the meat?"
"They certify it," Kathleen said. "But in this day and age, it's an unfortunate assumption to believe that it's not contaminated."
"How can that be?" Tracy asked.
"For a lot of reasons," Kathleen said, "chief of which is that the USDA has an inherent conflict of interest."
Kim lifted his head out of his hands. "How so?"
"It's because of the USDA's mandate," Kathleen said. "On the one hand, the agency is the official advocate for U.S. agriculture, which includes the powerful beef industry. That's actually the USDA's main job. On the other hand, it has inspectional obligations. Obviously, the two roles don't mix. It's a genuine case of asking the fox to guard the henhouse."
"This sounds incredible," Kim said. "Is this something you know for a fact, or is it something you've heard and are just passing it along?"
"I'm afraid it's something I know about firsthand," Kathleen said. "I've been looking into the problem of food contamination for over a year. I've gotten active through a couple of consumer groups who are fighting an uphill battle to do something about it."
"How did you get involved?" Tracy asked.
It would have been hard for me not to, Kathleen said. Food contamination and the illness it causes have become a major part of my practice. People in general seem to want to keep their heads in the sand about all this, but it's a problem that is getting worse by the day.
This is unbelievable, Kim exclaimed, as anger again overcame his sadness.
There's more, Kathleen said. Not only is there a conflict of interest with the USDA, but from what I've seen, the USDA and the beef industry are much too close.
What are you implying? Kim asked.
Exactly what I said, Kathleen added. Particularly in middle management positions, there's a kind of musical chairs with people moving back and forth to make sure the industry is interfered with as little as possible.
This is all for profit, no doubt, Kim said.
To be sure, Kathleen said. The beef industry is a multi-billion-dollar business. Profit maximization is its goal, not the public weal.
Wait a second, Tracy said. How can all this be true?
In the past, the USDA has uncovered problems and has done something about them. I mean, not that long ago with Hudson Foods.
Excuse me, Kathleen interrupted. The USDA was not responsible for discovering the E. coli contamination involving Hudson Foods. It was an attentive public health official. Normally what happens is the USDA is forced to make a show after an outbreak occurs. Then they make a big deal to the media to give the impression that they are on the job of protecting the public. But unfortunately, nothing substantial ever gets done. Ironically enough, the USDA doesn't even have the power to recall meat it finds contaminated. It can only make a recommendation. Nothing it determines is binding.
You mean like with Hudson Foods? Tracy asked. At first, they recommended that only 25,000 pounds of meat be recalled.
Exactly, Kathleen said. It was consumer groups that forced the USDA to up the recommended recall to over 1 million pounds. It wasn't the USDA who was the instigator.
I'd had no idea about any of this, Tracy said, and I like to think of myself as a reasonably informed person.
Perhaps the worst part, Kathleen continued, is that when the USDA talks about contamination with its inspectional services, they're generally talking about gross contamination with visible feces. The industry has fought against any microscopic or bacteriologic inspection for years. Now there is supposed to be some culturing, but it is only a token.
It's hard to believe, Tracy said. I guess I've always just assumed that meat was safe.
It's a sorry situation, Kathleen said, with tragic consequences. For a few moments, no one spoke.
How well we know, Tracy said, as if suddenly realizing this was no idle conversation. Her daughter was no abstraction. A fresh tear streaked down her cheek.
Well, that settles it, Kim said. He abruptly got to his feet.
Settles what? Tracy managed. Where are you going now?
To Bartonville, Kim said. I'm going to pay a quick visit to Mercer Meats.
I think you should stay here, Tracy said with exasperation. You know better than I that Becky's condition is grave. Dr. Stevens and Dr. Morgan have impressed upon me there might be some difficult decisions to be made.
Of course I know Becky's condition is grave, Kim snapped. That's why I have so much trouble sitting here doing nothing. It drives me crazy. I have trouble even looking at Becky, knowing there is nothing I can do medically to help. Besides, hearing all this about the beef industry and the USDA makes me furious. I said I was going to find out how she got sick. I'm going to follow this E. coli trail wherever it leads. At least I can do that for Becky.
What if we need you? Tracy asked.
My cellular phone is in my car, Kim said. You can call me. Anyway, I won't be gone that long.
Yeah, just like yesterday, Tracy said.
I've learned my lesson, Kim said. I'm not going to lose my temper. Tracy didn't look persuaded.
Go if you have to, she said irritably.
Kim stormed out of the ICU waiting room. Not only was Becky's relentless downward course weighing on him, but so was Tracy's hostility. Just the day before, she'd professed to understand his frustrations. Now it was as if she'd forgotten she'd ever said anything. Once on the freeway, Kim used his cellular phone to find Tom. He tried him several places before catching him in his lab at the hospital.
I have to ask another favor, Kim said.
How's Becky? Tom asked.
To be honest, she's very bad, Kim said.
I've been using a lot of denial about her condition, but I can't do that anymore. It doesn't look good. I had no idea this E. coli was so pathogenic and essentially untreatable once the toxin gets into the system. Anyway, I'm not optimistic. Kim paused, fighting tears.
I'm so sorry, Tom said. What a tragedy. What can I do to help?
Could you follow my inpatients for a couple of days? Kim managed.
I'm strung out.
No problem at all, Tom said graciously. I'll be doing my own rounds when I finish here in the next few minutes, and I'll just add them on. I'll also tell the nurses so they'll call me if there are any problems.
Thanks, Tom, Kim said. I owe you.
I wish I could do more, Tom said.
Me too, Kim said.
Bartonville was less than 40 minutes out of town. Kim cruised down its main street and then followed the directions he'd gotten from a service station at the freeway exit. He found Mercer Meats without a problem. It was a far bigger plant than he'd expected. The building was all white and modern-looking, but otherwise nondescript. The grounds were immaculately landscaped with granite-lined drives and islands of trees in the parking area. The whole complex projected an aura of high profitability. Kim parked relatively near the front door in one of a half dozen visitor spaces. He slid out from behind the wheel and started toward the entrance. As he walked, he reminded himself not to lose his temper. After the experience at the onion ring, he knew that if he did, it would only work against him. The reception area looked like it belonged at the entrance to an insurance company rather than a meatpacking concern. Plush, wall-to-wall carpeting covered the floor, the furniture was richly upholstered, and there were framed prints on the walls. Only the subject matter of the prints gave a hint of the nature of the business. They were prints of various breeds of cattle. A matronly woman wearing a cordless headset sat at a circular desk in the center of the room.
"May I help you?" she asked.
"I hope so," Kim said. "What's the name of the president of Mercer Meats?"
"That would be Mr. Everett Sorensen," the woman said.
"Would you call Mr. Sorensen and tell him that Dr. Kim Regis is here to see him?" Kim said.
"Can I tell Mr. Sorensen what this is about?" the woman asked.
She eyed Kim skeptically. His appearance was bordering on that of a homeless person. "Is it necessary?" Kim asked.
"Mr. Sorensen is a very busy man," the woman said.
"In that case," Kim said, "tell him it's about Mercer Meats selling contaminated hamburger patties to the Onion Ring restaurant chain."
"Excuse me?" the woman said.
She'd heard Kim, but couldn't quite believe it. Or better yet, Kim said, already beginning to forget his promise to himself about maintaining his composure, "tell him I'd like to discuss the fact that my only daughter is fighting for her life after consuming a Mercer Meats patty."
"Perhaps you'd like to sit down," the receptionist said.
She swallowed nervously. Kim was now leaning over her desk, resting on his knuckles.
"I'll give the president your message."
"Thank you," Kim said. He gave the woman a forced smile and retreated to one of the couches. The woman spoke into her headset while casting nervous glances in Kim's direction. He smiled again. He couldn't hear what she was saying, but from the look on her face, he knew it was about him. Kim had his legs crossed. He bounced his foot. 5 minutes dragged by. The more he waited, the more his anger flooded back. Just when he thought he couldn't sit there any longer, a man appeared with a long white coat, not dissimilar to the one Kim was wearing, except it was clean and pressed. On his head was a blue baseball hat with Mercer Meats emblazoned above the bill. He was carrying a clipboard. He came right up to Kim and stuck out his hand. Kim stood up and shook the man's hand, although he'd not intended to.
"Dr. Regis, I'm Jack Cartwright. I'm glad to meet you."
"Where's the president?" Kim asked.
"He's tied up at the moment," Jack said. "But he asked me to come out and talk with you. I'm one of the vice presidents, and, among other things, I'm in charge of public relations."
Jack was a stocky individual with a doughy face and a slightly upturned porcine nose. He smiled ingratiatingly. "I want to talk with the president," Kim said.
"Listen," Jack said without a beat, "I'm truly sorry to hear that your daughter is ill."
"She's more than ill," Kim said. "She's at death's door, fighting for her life against a bacteria called E. coli 015787. I imagine this is a bug you've heard of."
"Unfortunately, yes," Jack said.
His smile vanished. Everyone in the meat business is aware of it, especially after the Hudson meat recall. In fact, we're so paranoid about it, we make an effort to exceed, by far, all USDA rules, regulations, and recommendations. And as proof of our efforts, we've never been cited for a single deficiency.
I want to visit the hamburger patty production area, Kim said. He wasn't interested in Jack's obviously canned spiel.
Now that's impossible, Jack said. We understandably limit access to avoid contamination, but...
Hold up, Kim interjected as his face reddened. I'm a doctor. I understand contamination. I'll be willing to put on any suit that's normally worn in the area. Whatever has to be done, I'll do, but I'm not going to take no for an answer.
Hey, calm down, Jack said good-naturedly. You didn't let me finish. You can't go onto the production floor, but we have a glassed-in observation walk, so you can see the whole process. What's more, you don't have to change out of your street clothes.
Well, that's a start, I suppose, Kim said.
Great, Jack commented. Follow me.
Jack preceded Kim, leading him along a corridor.
Are you only interested in hamburger production? Jack asked. What about some other meat product, like sausage?
Just hamburger, Kim said.
Fine and dandy, Jack said cheerfully.
They got to a stair and started up.
I want to emphasize we're tigers about cleanliness here at Mercer Meats, Jack said. Hell, the entire meat production area gets cleaned every day. First with high-pressure steam, and then with a quaternary ammonium compound. I mean, you could eat off the floor.
Uh-huh, Kim intoned.
The whole production area is kept at 35 degrees, Jack said as they reached the top of the stairs.
He grabbed the handle of a fire door.
It's tough on the workers, but tougher on the bacteria. You know what I mean?
Jack laughed. Kim stayed silent. They went through the door and entered a glass-enclosed corridor perched a floor above the production area. It ran the entire length of the building.
Pretty impressive, wouldn't you say? Jack said proudly.
Where's the patty area? Kim asked.
We'll get to that, Jack said. But let me explain to you what all this machinery is doing.
Below, Kim could see workers going about their business. They were all dressed in white uniforms with white caps that resembled shower hats. They were also wearing gloves and shoe covers. Kim had to admit that the plant looked new and clean. He was surprised. He'd expected something significantly less impressive. Jack had to speak loudly over the sound of the machinery. The glass on either side of the walkway was single-paned.
I don't know if you are aware that hamburger is actually a blend of fresh meat and frozen, Jack said. It's coarse ground separately over there. Of course, the frozen stuff has to be defrosted first.
Kim nodded.
After the coarse grind, the fresh and the frozen meat are dumped into the formulation blender over there to make a batch. Then the batch is finally ground in those big grinders.
Jack pointed. Kim nodded.
We do 5 batches per hour, Jack said. The batches are then combined into a lot.
Kim pointed to a large rubber or plastic bin on wheels.
Does the fresh meat come in those containers? He asked. Yup, Jack agreed. They're called combo bins, and they hold 2,000 pounds. We're very particular with our fresh meat.
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.